I'm sorry, M, Alexandra repeated.
No, miss. M is sorry.
Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Remedial Magic Podcast. As always, my name is Brady, and I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend, Delbert. Welcome to episode 14 of season 2, I think.
Indeed.
Is that right?
Sounds right.
Indeed. And
how long?
Our third in a row.
Third week in a row that we've been back in the studio. That's been pretty cool. How long was our first season?
29.
Pretty long. Pretty long.
29 episodes?
Yeah. 29 chapter. No, maybe not, because we did the first three in the first episode, right?
I think
there were 29 total chapters.
I think it was 27 or 28 because of our finale.
True.
Something like that. This season's not even going to live to see the light of the 20th episode, though.
I mean, if we hurry up and get to book six, I'm sure that one will last 3 years.
It'll just depend, but this one is wrapping up pretty quick. This week, we're going to talk about chapters 28 and 29 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below, meaning that after this week, we will only have 8 chapters left, which is only going to be 3 or 4 more episodes. So that's pretty exciting news. And in other news, there is no other news. Nothing Harry Potter newsworthy has happened this week, at least that I found. Did you guys find anything?
I haven't heard a single thing about Harry Potter in the recent history or the recent days, so no.
Yeah, me either. I even just looked, and the best I could find was one of those trashy articles where it's like 10 times Hermione was in love with Harry but not Ron and stuff like that. So there is no news, and I don't really have anything else to say, to be honest.
Prayers up for Tua Tagovailoa. Hopefully his fingers have straightened out.
Yeah, I guess prayers for him and prayers for just Florida kind of in general.
Oh, true. Yeah, that was a hurricane. Yeah.
That was a hurricane indeed. They got smoked pretty hard. So if you live in Florida and listen to this podcast at the same time, we're thinking about you. I have never lived through a hurricane, but I imagine it's not the best.
Yeah, I'm sure it sucks.
And with that being said, we've taken care of all of the important things at the beginning here. And so I think if you guys are willing, we can get into our discussion like a whole 15 minutes earlier than we normally do.
I'm game. Let's get after it.
Excellent. This week, as I said just not that long ago, we're talking about chapters 28 and 29 of Alexander Quick and the Lands Below. We talked last week about chapters, I believe, 26 and 27. And things are going to start picking up now. I don't know if you got the gist of that, Baylor, from reading these chapters, but things are about to get very, very intense.
Yeah, it appears that way. I mean, it left us off at a pretty good cliffhanger, and especially when a house elf is telling them, I'm sorry that I have to do this for you, but you gave me no choice, basically, because of the pact. So definitely going to be taking off, so to speak, here in the final 10, 12 chapters.
It is a really, really exciting time in this book. I'm excited to get into it. Chapter 28 is called Wizards in the New World, and chapter 29 is called By the Magic on Your Kind. And so these two chapters are pretty interesting. One, because of the big cliffhanger at the end of this little section of chapters, but also because we learn a great deal more about the things we've talked about in the last few weeks regarding what's the relationship between colonial wizards and Native Americans, and what's the relationship between the quote-unquote old world and then the new world as well. Wizards in the New World especially gives us some more insight into that, which I think is pretty intriguing myself. And then we also finally get another appearance from Diana Grimm, who shows up to interrogate Alex and Max about what they did over the break because they know that they had some sort of contact with Abraham Thorne. And I find that conversation to be interesting as well. Now, the chapter called By the Magic on Your Kind, this is more of a chapter about the struggle that Max is having inside, I think, whether or not he should, one, inform Alex of what he's truly doing, and then, two, allow her to help him with that. And, again, a very interesting chapter, but more interesting for the fact of what it promises to come, at least in my opinion.
I'm glad that, I mean, I think it was expected because typically in a story, the main character is a part of the main part of the story. In this case, obviously it's the lens below. So I think it was expected, but I definitely didn't expect Alex to kind of just flip the bird at her brother and her father and kind of say, yeah, you're including me whether you like it or not. Get over it.
It's on brand for Alex to do that. I think for me, the more unexpected part is the fact that she did that and they kind of seem to have listened a little bit. Granted, I think Abraham's listening more out of what he believes he can achieve if she's helping out. But regardless, him and Max both sort of give in these two chapters, which is really the first time we've seen that happen in this story.
Yeah, I was going to agree with you there, Brady, in that honestly, this does sound like Alex, and more of the surprise is definitely in it working than necessarily in her trying to get involved.
It's really interesting because obviously whatever's happening is going to be incredibly dangerous for Max, and so you'd think he'd want help, but I completely understand his thinking and saying, yeah, maybe help would be good, but certainly not from a 13-year-old untrained witch.
Yeah, that's got to be what it is, in my opinion. Just she's very unrefined, and we've seen that time and time again in this book when, you know, she gets outwitted by both Max and his two friends that they duel with. So I kind of like can see Max being like, you know, it's almost like sending an untrained warrior untrained soldier into war, you know. It's not probably not going to end well. I mean, it might work out, but it probably won't end well. So,
I almost wonder, and we know now that this isn't the case, but if Max had, I mean, he has his two friends that we interact with, but if they were more aligned, or maybe if he didn't have the stigma of being a thorn or whatever it may be, if one of his friends, or even both, Bia and Martin, would have accompanied him on his mission as well. Like, I wonder why that's not the case.
And from the sounds of it, it sounded like he was planning to go by himself, regardless.
Right. So. That's what I mean. Like, why is that the case? If it sounds like this situation, he might need help, but he doesn't want to take a 12-year-old, why didn't he take, like, his friends that are more adept, or even take his father if he could, you know?
Yeah, I see what you're saying now, yeah. I don't know.
I'd agree.
Go ahead, Brady.
I'd agree with that as well, except for the fact that at some point in these two chapters, Max is talking about how he's doing this so that no matter what the outcome is, at least people will look at him and his sisters in a better light than they do currently. And so, Max's willingness to involve other people, I think, probably comes from a place of not wanting to put them in danger, even if it is Martin and Beatrice, who are a little bit more skilled. Because if he drags them down there and they all die, then the headline becomes Son of Abraham Thorne kills two innocent children in desperate quest to get to the lands below or whatever.
Yeah, it'd definitely be used against them. Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up the whole thing about no matter what happens, it makes him and his sisters in a better light. I thought that was an interesting, I guess I wouldn't have expected Max to take up the WJD simply so, you know, for that reason, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I'm off base, but I feel like it'd be family first. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I think it's tough to be family first when your father is Osama bin Thorne.
Ooh. Oh yeah, that's true.
That's toxic.
Well, I just want to toss a shout out to Marty, our boy from the Discord. Also, maybe edit out his name. Whoops. But Marty from the Discord, who in all of our conversations, we sort of align in the fact that the three of us don't really agree with what Abraham's got going on. We don't necessarily think he's the best father in the world. And Marty from the Discord doesn't exactly care for that sentiment, apparently, saying he's not liking the anti-Thorne bias of the podcast, and then accuses us of being in the Confederation's pocket as well. And then he suggests that we might open the next episode by calling Abraham Thorne Osama bin Thorne because we are radical Thornists.
Yeah. I mean, I personally have stated several times that I think Thorne is on the positive side of things. Obviously, yes, he does things that are probably not great, i.e. poison a bunch of people with the death, with not the death, but the ghost curse or whatever, or just curse them, you know, whatever. Obviously, that's not great, but I've always thought that, and I still think that Thorne is the good guy, quote-unquote, quote-unquote, good guy in this storyline.
I've just been waiting all this time for us to turn this into a political podcast, so here we go. It's interesting to call him Osama bin Thorne or whatever, because on the other side of it, right, with Afghanistan, Iraq, and the United States, you also have George Bush, and there's like this video going around of him condemning Putin's attack in Ukraine, and he goes up and says it's just not fair that this one figurehead in power of this entire country would ever do this and invade Iraq. Ukraine. So, I mean, I feel like him saying that and us talking about Osama bin Thorne and everything just highlights what we've been saying the entire time on the podcast, that everyone's probably pretty bad. Like, Thorne is probably a bad person. The Confederation is probably a bad person. I still think Alex is a bad person. So, basically, the world sucks.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you say that you still think he's good, Baylor, for kind of along those same lines, maybe not quite as radically as Delbert put it, but for kind of along those same lines where you have, I don't think there's any evidence at all that he's ever done something positive for society in that manner. The only real evidence we have, I guess, is his known association with people who do negative things for society. I'm certainly not suggesting that you're wrong, because five books in, we don't really necessarily have an answer anyways. But I find it interesting that you're sticking with that so rigidly.
Yeah.
I'd be the first to admit that his actions aren't the best, you know, with just what we saw the last arc, but and I also don't think necessarily he's a good person, but I think what he's fighting for to end the corruption, if there is corruption. Obviously, if there's no corruption, then my whole argument is thrown out the door and I'm completely wrong, but if there is corruption, then he's on the right side of the spectrum, I guess. That's all I'm meaning.
I want to believe that Abraham Thorne is neither good nor evil. He's just extremely petty. And he was, like, really upset at Huckstein when they were in government together. So, like, he went to go get the House Elf Better Treatment Act done just so rich people had, like, a worse time abusing their House Elves. It's not actually for their benefit. It's just to make everyone's life a little bit worse.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
You know, we're kind of backwards in this chapter because we're talking about Abraham once again, and I guess in this section, because most of this conversation really comes in chapter 29. But since we're there, we might as well address this conversation that Max and Alex have in the library prior to Alex kind of convincing Max that she needs to be part of his scheme or whatever. Is we have basically Max spilling the beans about exactly what he's doing. at Tarnbridge, getting mixed in with the Mors Mortis Society, one, but then also, secondly, trying to find the portal to the lands below for his father. I think this conversation maybe is the most important conversation that we've seen so far in this book, because it's confirmation of what Alex has been thinking the entirety of the book, and also that kind of parallels in the first book where she had this crackpot theory the entire story and everybody was kind of not lending credit to it until the very end. And here we are again, right? Max does have a secret mission for his father, and Alex knew it the whole time. Nobody would tell her, though.
Yeah, it was, it opened my eyes, I guess, opened the kind of the box of uncertainty, because it's an interesting thing. He has this mission from his father to find the entrance to the lands below and go into the lands below to try and see what deal the Confederation agree to with these creatures that live in the lands below, and see if he can if he can do it better so they're on his side. That's quite an elaborate scheme, especially because we figure out that the Confederation kind of went behind the Native American wizard's back, made this deal with these people in the lands below, and went basically and sealed up all the entrances, and basically hid them in plain sight by building schools, Gringotts, etc. on them. And so it's quite the plan, I would say, to send your son into by himself, for sure.
It is, and my theory about that entirely as regarding Abraham sending Max in is that Abraham might care about Max, but not as much as he cares about like getting one over on the Confederation and proving that they're the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. I do think this conversation also gave us clarity as to why Max did not want Alex involved. And that's because basically once she agreed to help out, she can no longer unagree to help out. Like, she becomes a member of the Thorn Circle, basically. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I found that to be really interesting, that Max says, you know, by telling our father that you want to help, and now by being nosy enough to where I kind of have to let you help, you can never get out of this again if you make this choice. Like, once you're in it, father won't ever let you leave. And I like that they brought up the Thorn Circle again, because last season we had a conversation about whether Ben Journey trying to kill Alex broke the Thorn Circle, and it kind of sounds like the answer is no now. Like, the Thorn Circle still exists.
Yeah, even,
and so,
even their discussions on the train, they were talking about how they were wondering if her protection from being the Secret Keeper extended to Max because he joined the Thorn Circle after she was made Secret Keeper, which was interesting.
I just feel like the details of what's happening finally getting spilled to Alex just confirm essentially the things that we've been thinking this entire time, right? That Max obviously does have a mission both for the WJD and for his father, that the mission for his father is incredibly dangerous, right? And that Alex, whether Max believes it or not, Alex can probably help more than he would like to admit.
Yeah, I agree.
I also love that this book details different ways of getting what you want, right? Like, we've had Max in this evil society, or so-called evil society, Mors Mortis, through this entire book trying to figure out how to do this. And Alex found it by talking to a house elf. You know, it's nice to see that expanding your horizons and trying things a different way can work out as well.
Yeah, I think so. And Alex has this really special thing about her where she's the main character of the story. And so if progress runs through her, which is why she's kind of the key to Max accomplishing what he's been trying to accomplish this whole time. Anyways, but I agree with what you're saying that we see Alex accomplish the thing she's trying to do through many different outlets, sometimes even by accident. So it's not always just a direct action by her that's causing things to move forward. Even this, even her having the obol and having the key to going to the lands below for Max isn't a direct action by her. It's something that she just happened upon because her bird stole a coin.
Right, but I also want to push this to a different conversation because I know you, me, and a mutual friend, I forget if Baylor was still on Discord at the time, were talking about Harry Potter the other day and how there's a lot of stuff from early books that makes a reappearance later in. Do you think this was planned from the beginning that Charlie going after shiny things would mean he gets the obol, and also Alex getting detention in the first book would lead to her being friendly with the elves who are like these so-called ferrymen in the second book? Was that all pre-planned, or is that just something that made sense?
Oh, I think it's much more likely that the elf thing was pre-planned than for Charlie to steal the obol. I guess they both seem very well thought out regardless, but I don't think you pull the elf thing without much more forethought.
Right.
I'm under the personal impression that they weren't planned past this book. So first book happened, whatever, but then, I mean, Charlie didn't start stealing stuff till this book. And really, Bran and Poe don't really have anything to do with him. Because the only way she ran into him was the Mooresborne Society, which was this book. So that's kind of my personal impression. Obviously, we don't know. Inver already write in, but, you know, he probably
right.
won't.
And I guess to debate you, I guess, on what you just said, isn't Charlie, like, fascinated with the locket in book one because it's, like, this shiny thing? So that's what I meant, like, as far as him being interested in the obol. And then secondly, I was not really talking about M being the actual ferryman, but rather Bran and Poe informing Alexandra what the coin was.
I don't really think Charlie was interested in the locket because it was shiny, to be honest. Like, obviously, ravens and birds in general are more attracted to shiny things, but Charlie is special just by nature of the book. Placing a lot of emphasis on the fact that he's special. And so I think it's more the fact that it had at one time belonged to Abraham Thorne, that he was mostly interested in it. And then the obol is a dark artifact, and Charlie is a quote-unquote dark familiar. And so I think that most likely is why he took that. The other stealing of just like common everyday things, like gum wrappers and stuff, I think that's more of his natural bird behavior, but I think it's too much of a coincidence that Charlie steals shiny things and just so happens that every important object in this story is a shiny thing.
It's also a good point because I don't necessarily know if an obol is even shiny, is it?
It's a coin.
It's an ancient coin, though. Like, if you look at ancient Roman coins that people sell and collect and all that stuff, they're not really shiny anymore.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, but these are also wizards, and so it's a magic coin and blah, 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 whatever. Regardless if it was planned out beforehand or not, I think it is incredibly well thought out, right? It's not a leap. You don't have to take a leap to believe that the elves are the ones involved with this. You don't have to take a leap to believe that Charlie stole the obol. If Inver already wrote it that Charlie likes to steal things, and then later went, oh, he could steal this obol, that's how I can introduce it. That's just as impressive as if he already had the obol in mind when he decided Charlie likes to steal stuff.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I'm gonna go out on a limb here and kind of bait Inverardi into answering on the Discord, maybe.
Ooh.
I think that Charlie stealing first the Mooresmoor's coin and this obol was a convenient transition because I don't think that he could figure out how to transition between each section of the book. I'm gonna throw that out there.
That's interesting.
I don't necessarily believe that because I think Imbrardi's a really good writer, and I think I'm kind of on board with you guys that he plans this stuff out. But I'm gonna bait him into maybe answering that question for us.
That is interesting because you're right. Playing devil's advocate, he might have written himself into a corner by making the Mors Mortis Society thing a coin and then going, oh, wait, what about the obol?
Right.
How do I make another mysterious coin show up?
Yeah.
It is a little bit too easy that Charlie just showed up with both of them.
I tend, and the reason I say I'm kind of on your guys' side now is because I think if she doesn't have a personal relationship with a house elf, such as Bran and Poe, or even M later in the first book, that little drop that he gives us about house elves being the ferryman between the lands above and the lands below, I don't think that lands as impactful as it does because Alex learned it from a house elf. You know, like she sees firsthand, like, oh my goodness, these house elves here, my friends basically ferry people to this very dangerous place. And they have to if they have this coin.
This might be different for somebody like Inverardi, who is clearly a more experienced writer than I am and probably more creative, and maybe you can echo what I'm going to say here, Delbert, but one thing I have to say for sure is when you're creating a story and you decide you want this certain character or this certain group of characters or whatever to play a bigger role, I find it difficult to fit the story around that in a way that seems cohesive and understandable to people who might be experiencing the story from outside of your perspective. And so that's one of the reasons why I think there's some planning going in beforehand rather than just saying, oh, I wrote the house elves and I want them to be important. Let me rearrange the story around them.
I sure hope this is a D&D reference because absolutely. I remember when I was making my campaign, I wanted it to feel open and whatnot, and then I was like, okay, I'll give them this first obvious hook, and nobody wanted to take the first obvious hook, especially the guy that it was designed for, and I'm like, well, now what? So I see what you mean as far as, like, trying to make something important can be difficult, because sometimes people aren't just gonna see it that way.
Obviously, book characters don't have free will in the same way that you do in real life making decisions. But this is a little bit restricted because Inverardi was releasing this book on a schedule.
Right.
And so when it's time for these chapters to come out, they come out so that people will stay interested. So that's just something interesting to consider going forward. And something we can look for as we get into the future books is, what callbacks do we see from these earlier books that like fit nicely into the story that push the storylines in later books along? You know, we can make connections between book one and two, but I think it will be much more impressive if we can make connections between book one and book five. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving along here a little bit, we're going to jump just backwards a touch. Because Max and Alex also talk about the colonial wizards and what happened when they came over to the New World. It sounds like the conversation we had a while ago, I don't know if it was last episode or two episodes ago, but about when did wizards show up? It sounds like maybe that's answered, like they did come over around the same time as the Muggle colonials did. And the reason I say that is because just like Muggles, it's confirmed that just like Muggles were having battles with Native Americans, so were the colonial wizards. And it's mentioned in here that even the colonial wizards were protecting the colonial Muggles sometimes from the Native Americans because the Native Americans have some kind of innate magical gifts.
If this is all like canonically correct, I'm not going to say who's in the right because, you know, both sides committed quite a few atrocities between the colonials and Indians. I would argue that the Native Americans were probably the ones who deserved to stay in the land they had resided in for thousands of years, but It does make me chuckle just a little bit that the Salem witch trials, which were put on by colonials and killed more colonials, means that they were killing their own witches in, like, the war between them and the Indians, I guess.
Right. But they weren't killing any witches and wizards. It's well documented in the Harry Potter universe that wizards would just pretend to be in pain while putting a tickling charm on themselves.
Ooh.
There's one. Yeah. I don't remember what her name was. Wendolyn the Weird or something.
I didn't know this was a thing.
Yeah. Wendolyn the Weird enjoyed it so much that she got caught like 15 times on purpose.
Bizarre.
Yeah. Hence the weird moniker on her name.
Right.
Now, I found this story interesting, just how much it mirrored, like, what we know as real life between colonials and Native American, like, relations back in the 1800s. Like, it's very much the same case where our government came in and decided that we own the land and you're going to become part of our culture. Like, that was very much what happened in real life. And so I appreciate that Inverarity mentioned that as well in the story. So I don't know. I liked how he wrote that, how he fit the magical themes in with what actually happened in real life.
I think something we have to address about that is the fact that if we're going to go by what Inverarity is saying, that it's likely that the Muggle colonials were influenced by the witches and wizards that won the battles against the Native Americans, because the witches and wizards that won the battle against the Native Americans also gave them dedicated spots in the country to go live, like reservations. If I had to guess, I would say that these designated spots line up pretty well with the reservations created by the Muggles in this instance. And so I think maybe that the colonial witches and wizards thought, well, it'll just be easier if we handle this and then make the Muggles think it was their idea.
Yeah. I also think that from my understanding, most of the Native Americans, if not all of them, had some kind of magical ability. And so it makes sense now, like if I'm comparing it to real life, that Native Americans would be non-magical, because when our government went in, they went around, you know, they went behind the back of the Native Americans and shut down their magical sources, basically. And so basically right. Cutting off their magic. And so it makes a lot of sense how Inverarity wrote it. And now there's like not really very many magical Native Americans.
I would love to know. So I guess for some context, we're talking about how the portal to the lands below that's beneath Charmbridge is not the only one. And most of these portals to the lands below, if not all, were covered up by schools and by banks and a few other things. And I would hazard a guess that the specific places that the Native Americans were relocated to throughout the country don't coincide with the places where these portals to the land below are.
Yep.
And because of that, I think you're right, Baylor, that took away their natural magical powers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
That's something very interesting to think about, because that is an atrocity all in itself, right?
Yeah, it's very fitting for the white man to come in and take Native Americans' land and then build a white man memorial. I say white man as a colonial memorial such as Gringotts, or a massive school that's world-renowned, you know, right on top of a Native American sacred area, you know, like
there's that stuff happening in history. There's a very funny YouTube channel called Oversimplified, and they put a video out a couple months ago called The War of the Pig, and it was a war that almost occurred between the U.S. and Canada. But for a brief part of that video, it highlights exactly what you're talking about with American expansion westward, Baylor. And the comedic look of it was they all get in a church and say it's our God-given right to manifest destiny, and then when they leave the church, they start planting McDonald's on top of teepees and using B-52 stealth bombers to bomb herds of bison and laying down railroad and being just a nuisance overall. So it's funny to visualize that in a comedic way, but you're absolutely right as well that it's like really a dark act and like a dark part of history as well.
Yep, absolutely.
I will say one thing from chapter 28 that I find to be pretty interesting is Max essentially confirming that what we've been saying for a while and basically calling most of the Mors Mortis Society a bunch of posers who don't matter.
Yeah.
So I found that to be pretty interesting. But this chapter, the conversation between Max and Alex is very revealing of the state of the wizarding world, I think, in terms of relations between the Confederation and then those who have been forced to live under the Confederation. But it's also very revealing because we finally find out for sure what Max is trying to do. And I don't know. I can't get past the fact that it feels like Abraham is telling Max to do this, and if you die, well, so be it type of situation. Now, Alex is a smart girl, and do you think that she's picked up on that too, which is why she wants to help so much?
Well, I think so, because she's very big both in chapter 28 and also 29 that it should be Abraham going into the lands below, not Max. And so, yeah, I completely agree that she's of the impression that, yeah, it shouldn't be you, Max. You know, like, he's basically setting you up to fail, pretty much.
Why isn't it?
That's exactly what I was about to say. Why isn't it? Max, in this chapter, says, well, it can't be him, because if he sets foot on Charmbridge, the WJD will know. But I don't agree.
No, he just polyjuice potioned or whatever himself through an entire dance under the eyes of plenty of aurors.
This is 100%, in my opinion, the reason he's not going is because he could go. Surely he could go. He probably has access to an oboe right now, you know. But if he goes and something happens to him, then all of his plans go down the drain anyways. So rather sacrifice somebody else than risk myself.
Or is he just a straight coward?
He could be a coward. We don't know enough, I think, to know if he is or isn't a coward, but I don't know. It doesn't sit right with me that Max says he would get arrested immediately, because it's just blatantly untrue, I think.
It's very much like a criminal organization, right? Like, you know, the mob or whatever. You don't see the mob boss doing all the dirty work. It's all of his little minions.
I mean, he is a pretty apt... Yeah, it's exactly like the mob or like a politician, right? Like what he used to be. Where it's, oh, Congress is going to start a war, but you best believe they're not sending themselves to fight it.
Right. Well, it's like, it's not even like just criminal organizations or the government. It's any organization you can think of. The higher you move up in the organization, the less you have to do for yourself.
Right.
Right. The more you can delegate. And that's exactly what he's doing here, is delegating. Why he's delegating to his son, I don't know, but he is. So.
Yeah, I mean, even the Congress, they still got their sons out of Vietnam, so he must either not give a shit or not have anybody else who can help him.
I mean, it kind of... It kind of makes
very
me wonder... I know we saw Zachary, which we learned that Zachary was not actually Zachary, and also, on a funny note, Zachary was polyjuiced himself to look like the head of the Aura Department, which was interesting because we figured, I guess... What was suggested was you can polyjuice. You can polyjuice yourself off of someone else who's polyjuiced and look like the person they polyjuiced. Did I understand that correctly?
I'm pretty sure that Zachary was under the influence of the Imperious Charm, because I think Zachary is the head of the Aura Department, and Abraham Thorne polyjuiced himself to look like Zachary.
Interesting, because now we have a third opinion. He is the head of the Auror's office, or whatever, and also a member of the Thorn Circle.
Right, and that's fine, but Abraham went to the dance looking like Zachary.
Yeah. Right, because he was an unknown member of the Thorn Circle because no one told on him because they can't.
Well, didn't
sure. So,
I'm just saying the Thorn Circle might have some high up people in the government still operating in the government.
Well, I'm sure it does.
That would be interesting, yeah. But didn't Max say that Abraham wasn't the only one under Polyjuice Potion that night?
He may have.
That's why I said that. But anyways, that point aside, that would be very interesting, both if Imperius, the head of the Aura Department, and they have an inside guy basically at the top of the government of the Confederation.
It does make sense now how he was able to just parade around without being questioned, right, though, since he was everyone's boss.
Well, it says, Zachary Stanton is the chief of Roanoke's Aura Authority. The other Aurors probably thought their boss was being quite bold dancing with you when he's speaking to Alex, and now they're wondering how Abraham Thorne managed to literally dance right under their noses pretending to be him. So Abraham was pretending to be this Zachary person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it was bold of him to be there to begin with, but it's a clear illustration of his power and even more evidence to the fact that he could go to Charmbridge and go to the lands below if he wanted to.
Exactly.
He's a master manipulator, which we already knew.
But what I was getting at was that you guys have been asking why is he relying on Max so much, and whether the Zachary person, obviously it's not Zachary, but if it was somebody that was Polyjuice, if it somebody that's Imperius, whatever, do you think that there's a chance that the Thorn Circle doesn't exist? Like it exists, but there's nobody in it. And so that's why Abraham has to rely on his son so much. Because there's like nobody else that he can send. Because there's nobody else with him.
Oh, I think there's a great chance that it's very similar to when Voldemort lost his powers and everybody just assimilated back into society the best they could. And the Thorn Circle may have broken up for that reason, because everybody hasn't heard from Abraham Thorne in so long. I think that's certainly a plausible explanation.
Right. Yeah, I'm just saying, like, maybe he has lost support of all of his people. You know, the so-called Thorn Circle, which is full of people, they don't support him anymore, so they don't help him at all.
Brady, that's I'm going to ask you this because I don't think it's a spoiler, but I want to make sure. Do we know through Book 5 how many people are in Thorn Circle?
I don't think so.
Okay. Because I have it in my head that it's 13, and I don't know why, but then I was thinking about it, and I mean, could it not just be like 500? Could it not just be a massive organization as well?
I can answer that question from the perspective of somebody who's never read the books, because I don't remember.
Right.
So it very well could be, or it very well could be like Baylor saying, that the Thorn Circle doesn't exist in the same way that it did. Like,
right.
It exists, but it's not full of people willing to throw their lives away for Abraham Thorne anymore.
Yeah, so I found the quote from the book about the Polyjuice Potion. And it was when Alex and Max were talking about Mrs. Grimm's, or Diana Grimm's, interview with her. And she said that Diana Grimm made her describe Zachary, is that going to be a problem for him? I had to reveal his identity. And then Max said, do you think that was his real name, or that our father was the only one using Polyjuice Potion that night? So, I don't know.
Right, but that's the thing that I don't really understand, I guess. The guy who was at the woods with Abraham that Alex saw called himself Zachary, or somebody did, but that's not his actual name. I guess it's just a protective measure from Abraham to protect that guy's identity or something.
Yeah, if it's anything like Ben Journey, his name's probably Zach.
Yeah, true. Zacharias.
Yeah.
Ben instead of Benjamin. Although I guess I don't know if we ever find out if Benjamin is his real name.
No, it's Benedict.
Oh, Benedict.
Yeah, Benjamin definitely wasn't his real name.
Same thing.
Yeah, because it was Benedict.
Same thing. Close, you know what I mean? Like, it's not Ron Swanson or Timothy... whoever.
Right.
It's just a longer version of Ben.
Right. Regarding the interview with Diana Graham, did you guys find their strategy interesting? Like, telling the truth? Like, how they did it?
Not really. I think it's easy.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the easiest way to lie and get away with it, honestly, this is advice for anybody who's listening, is to stay as close to the truth as possible. Meaning you say things that are correct and that are right, and you just leave out the stuff you don't want to say. You don't change the story. You don't say anything different. You just leave out the stuff you don't want to say. And that's like their strategy here. And I think it's bold to lie to the government, I guess. But at the same time, it is incredibly effective because they can't call you a liar.
Right. Yeah, no, I get that part. I figured that they would be a little more careful. I know they didn't reveal anything, but that they would be a little bit more careful just given, like, associating with a known criminal, you know, can be a crime itself.
I also think it's stated, though. I also think it's stated, too, though, from Max or something, but it says that, like, Abraham knows that his children are being interviewed. So, I mean, he also is only telling them things that he trusts them with. You know what I mean? Like, he knows that if he tells them something, that the government might know. So he's already playing, like, the next move ahead on a chessboard while they figure out what he's trying to do.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the WJD already knows that Abraham visits his kids.
Right.
They already know that, so saying that they were with him doesn't really put them in any danger. And on top of that, I don't think the WJD would ever arrest Max and Alex because they are literally the closest they can get to finding out what Abraham's doing.
Yeah.
If they took that away from Abraham, he would either lose his mind and cause some serious problems, or they would just lose the ability to, like, check in on him every so often.
I also wonder, too, and we're dealing with Alex, who is, you know, a lot younger than Max and seemingly younger than some of her other siblings as well that we haven't met. How many times has Abraham Thorne told his daughters or Max or whoever something that was just total BS? And then that led the WJD down on a, you know, month-long loophole of thinking they were ahead of him. And it was just a red herring the whole time.
I think that's also a fair assessment.
Yeah.
He's certainly not past lying to his kids.
Again, he's incredibly manipulative. So there's no, you can't just say, nah, he wouldn't do that. Because right. He would if it gets him ahead.
So even if the WJD finds out, oh, he's trying to get to the lands below, they still don't know if that's true.
Right. No, I completely agree with you guys. I'm trying to remember when it was specifically brought up, because at the end of the first book, when she's meeting with Governor General Huckstein, you know, he hands that card to her and says, if you ever see your dad or have communication with your dad, you know, get in touch with me or touch the logo or whatever. And she obviously throws it away. But so I guess I can't remember when it was specifically decided that, oh yeah, she's meeting with Abraham Thorne regularly. I guess maybe Max told them? I don't know.
I don't know about that. I think it's more likely that they knew it would happen at some point.
Yeah, because it probably happened with all her siblings, right? Like, Max was clearly in contact, Julia has been, and I assume the others have as well.
I have a distinct feeling that Abraham visits Max when he's at Roanoke fairly often. And so, Diana Grimm, is that who it is? Diana?
Yeah.
Yes.
Diana Grimm probably, like, planned this. Oh, they're going to Roanoke for spring break? Well, then I'm going to interview them when they go back to Charmbridge.
Right. And I think also pushing Alex like Huckstein did and like Diana Grimm did is probably because they've been interviewing the kids for so long. This is their first chance at a kid that might hate their father. Like, because all the other ones panned out to probably not give them a ton of intel or, like, side with them against him.
Sure.
And Alex being unbeknownst and being abandoned and everything, they were probably like, okay, we need to make a good impression so that she's on our side.
Sure. I think that's fair. It's very interesting, this interplay, right? Because Alex is definitely caught in the middle. She hasn't really fully decided whose side she's on, necessarily. So the fact that she's in the middle, she could flip either way at any time is a fun thing to read. But it's clear that she doesn't trust her father or the government.
I believe she did choose a side. She said, I'm on my side.
Right.
Two chapters ago.
She chose her own side.
Yeah.
We're running out of time here pretty swiftly. There's one more thing we need to talk about that's very important. And that's the fact that Max finally agrees to take Alex to the lands below with him. So then he trains her for a month, and Anna decides to show the dumb side of her brain again and accuses Max of beating up Alex again.
Right.
Even though we know that's not true. And then they go to the lands below.
Well, they beat the shit out of Darla and John Manuel Ito. Also, I find it funny that Max is slamming John into either side of this, like, cave or whatever it is and slamming him on his head. Not much regard for human life there, but even he has to stop Alexandra. So, I mean, I don't know what she was doing to Darla, but not good.
Well,
I think there's to back up a touch. Pent-up anger.
Yeah.
Little bit.
Play. Yeah.
Darla must know that there's something going on with Alex because of the change in Alex's appearance. She's clearly been training. And also, Alex can sense Darla watching her at different points throughout her days at Charmbridge. And that causes Darla to get John and follow Alex and Max down to the chamber where the portal to the lands below is. And then we get that conflict that you just described, Delbert, between John, Darla, Max, and Alex. And you're correct when you say that it felt certainly like Max was trying to kill John and Alex was trying to kill Darla.
It was pretty messy.
It's almost comical to me how different fight scenes are in this book series compared to Harry Potter. Like, it's very unexpected just because I'm used to the kind of the mundane stupefy, oh, they're unconscious, sounds good. Instead of this, like, physical, like, literally beating that someone's head over a rock repeatedly. You know,
yeah,
like it's a stark difference.
It's a huge difference, and I think it's more realistic.
Oh, absolutely.
To be honest, the way it's happening here.
Well, it's.
I will say, John casts a cool spell in this, where he causes giant stone hands to come out of the floor and grab a hold of Alex and Max. And then at the end of the conflict, once John has been incapacitated, one of the stones has grabbed Max's foot so hard that it's shattered all of his toes. And Max just relocates the wound onto John.
Yeah.
That is some savage business.
Yeah. It also means that Max is once again proving how powerful he is, because they said when they learned that spell that if you become powerful enough, you'll be able to transfer your wounds to someone else. So, once again, Max is showing his power here.
Max is a bad mamma jamma, yeah. I'm telling you.
I wanted to say one more thing about the fight scenes. It's interesting to me because with this new video game coming out that's obviously sponsored by, or I guess maybe not sponsored, but, you know, has the blessing of the Wizarding World. I can't remember exactly what their company is called. But, like, the fight scenes in the trailers that we've seen for the video game are much more similar to this kind of fighting versus what we see in the books. So it's interesting that the Wizarding World is shifting more that way as well.
Well, it's partially because that's the way to make it more fun in the game, is to make the scenes more dynamic and stuff. But also, again, I think it's more realistic. You're not just going to cast one stupefy and then move on with your day. It's going to be an actual fight, right? Really, the only duel we get in the entire main series that is even somewhat similar to these duels is between Dumbledore and Voldemort at the Ministry of Magic. And even that, it doesn't feel like somebody's about to die from the description like these ones do.
I will say, though, Alex and Darla is exactly like what we've seen in that video game. She levitates her up into the air and then just flings hex after hex after hex into her. Yep. That's exactly what we see in those video game trailers. And this was written, what, 12 years ago, 15 years ago?
Sure.
Right. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think those... Sorry, Brady, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in those video game trailers, the one that seems the most brutal and also made me laugh the most was somebody levitating one of the goblins and just bouncing it off the ground over and over like a basketball.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Max is doing to John here.
Right.
A little bit.
Yeah,
absolutely. I just wanted to compliment Inverardi. I know I called you out a little earlier, so I'm just sweetening you up a little bit here. The writing in these scenes is so good. Like, you feel like you're there. Like, you feel the bruises. You feel like when he was explaining Max's toes being crushed. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I felt like that happened to me just the way he wrote. So I just, once again, compliment his writing. It's very good.
I agree. So much so that this chapter changed my mind about doggerel verse.
Yeah.
I used to think it was stupid sounding until Alex uses it to break an ancient compact and summon a house elf that doesn't belong to her to her side.
On top of that, I'd like to point out she practiced this, which is excellent.
Yeah.
The ones she doesn't practice are quite bad.
Yeah. It's almost fitting, right? Because they're going to go into this old world place where wands aren't a thing. And so she uses basically unapproved magic in order to get there. I think it's very fitting with the turns in the story.
It's very fitting. I absolutely agree with you there. This scene with M is very intense, I think. It's like so much darker than you realize at first, because once they summon M, they tell her about the students who have been practicing dark magic and tell her where John and Darla is, but then they show M the obol, or Alex does, and I think if Alex and Max had changed their mind at that point and decided not to go, it's too late.
They're expelled. They're done.
Well, like, it's too late not to go. I think M would not have let them leave,
because
they've like sealed the ancient compact just by showing her the obol and demanding that she takes them to the lands below, because then M doesn't say no or anything. She just apologizes about what she's about to do to them.
Yeah, I will say, on my first read of this section, I thought we were about to get a plot twist that just didn't happen, because I thought Alex summoned the elf, Alex presented the coin, I thought she alone was going to be sent to the lands below, but it does appear in the last chapter or last paragraph that both her and Maximilian fall through.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to leave Max behind because it was only the one obol.
It's very interesting. That definitely could have happened. Yeah. But I think the lands below isn't nearly as scary as Inverardi's making it be if Alex can go there and then come back.
Right.
You know what I mean? She needs help from an older person to do that, I think. So I like that didn't happen, even though that is certainly something that could have happened.
Yeah. Could you imagine Maximilian?
Yeah.
He would have been pretty... He probably would have killed the elf.
Would have been frantic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a very, very dark way to end this section of chapters, I think, because it really is... M doesn't say no. M doesn't say, I can't do that. How dare you? She just starts crying and apologizes to the children for what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Pretty terrifying.
It's dark.
It's pretty dark, but that is where this section of chapters ends. I don't believe we're going to have a casting this week because we didn't really get anybody new.
Nope.
So instead, Baylor, why don't you tell us who your ARC MVP was?
Yeah, so I went with Abraham Thorne. And the reason why, not because he did anything overly great, but I kind of believe you guys, the last episode you were talking about, he kind of plants the seed in Alex's mind about basically forcing her way into the lands below, into the plan, whatever. And I believe it worked. So good on him to play as his children, like a fiddle. So
I can't fault what you just said, because he did plant the seed and it turned around and worked. You know, and then he manipulated Max into agreeing with it. So yep. Alex is here once again because of Abraham. Delbert, what about you?
I'm going to take two ARC MVPs here.
Okay.
If you'll allow it.
Yeah, sure.
Brandon Poe.
Brandon Poe.
Not referenced at all, really.
Well, they did get mentioned.
They did get a mention. But had they not befriended Alex, she wouldn't have known what to do with the... She wouldn't have even known what the obol was. So without what we talked about with whether this was set up before or whether Inverarity used it as like something at the time of writing it, it all went back to Brandon Poe.
Yeah, I agree. Alex knew enough to get here, I think, because of them.
Honorable mention to M, though. Really, I wanted to just give it to all the house elves, but three MVPs is a lot.
Yeah.
As far as I go, I'm going to use this opportunity to pick Alex, because while Abraham's kind of the reason that she got here, Alex is the reason she got here. You know, her headstrong determination has led us to this point, to the point of them dropping through the floor into some kind of darkness, whether that's the lands below or just a box that Dean Grimm has set up to trap students who are trying to do dark magic. Who knows? But Alex forced her way into this position, and much, much more effectively than we saw her ever do anything in the first book.
I can always get behind the title character being the MVP.
Yep.
It's an easy one.
Yeah.
What about renaming the arc? Baylor, did you come up with a good name this time?
Probably not, but I'll go ahead and list it off here. I said Into the Below.
Into the Below.
Yeah, probably not the best. That's all right.
That sounds okay. I'd give it a rating of some kind.
A rating of some kind. Excellent.
Delbert, did you come up with a title for this arc?
I have two, and my serious one is ruined now because it was Into the Darkness, which is just the same thing as Baylor's.
Wow.
So instead, I'll go with my comedic one and say Charmbridge's Chamber of Secrets.
Charmbridge is Chamber of Secrets. Wow.
Charmbridge's.
Charmbridge's Chamber possessive. Of Secrets.
Charmbridge's.
Sure.
Okay.
It's a nice reference to the...
The other book, too.
The other book, too. There's a little bit of a parallel going on there. We can get behind it, I suppose.
Yeah.
My title for this one is Abraham Thorne Gets His Way.
Brady finally wins.
Yep, that sounds pretty good.
By default.
We used my title for the last episode title as well.
Oh, hell yeah. Good.
Two in a row. But
Who's counting?
Abraham Thorne Gets His Way just because... he's been wanting Max to get into the lands below this entire book, and
voila.
It appears that that's happening.
Right.
Baylor, you said you thought of another one?
I did, yeah. I thought, I'm sorry, love M.
I don't think there's much love there.
I like it, though. I like the snarkiness of it, for sure. So there you go. There's our ARC MVPs and ARC new ARC titles, which means we only have one thing left, and that is to do the prediction segment. So, Baylor, if you would remind us of what your prediction from last week was, we can give it a grade.
Okay. Sorry, took a couple minutes there. Because I have nothing, absolutely nothing going on. So I just decided to throw some paint on a wall and see where it stuck. So we'll pick right back up where we left it during chapter 27. And Max will be telling Alex all about the plan that Abe has given him. Basically, Manuelito has ties to Abe's enemies, and he is using Max to try and find out what they have against him. Max is appearing to work as a government operative, so that way it shows Manuelito that he can be trusted. AKA, he's against his father. In other news, Darla attempts to go into lands below and fails miserably because Alex stops her. And this time, Alex gets the last laugh. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay.
First part's kind of the opposite.
I was thinking that while you were while it was being played, is that
he's gonna befriend John Manuel Ito instead of yeah. killing him.
Yeah.
And to pretend like he, or to show that he's not doing his father's bidding, but he was.
Right.
And then Darla didn't try to get in the lens below. That was, well, Alex.
She was trying, but I think, right? Like, that's why she had the oval.
Well, sure,
no?
But she wasn't trying in this chapter.
Yeah. I mean, I think she was trying to get the oval back.
I do have to say, Alex did get the last laugh.
She did get the last
Absolutely,
laugh.
She got the last laugh.
Can I make one defense to my...
Yeah, of course.
The Manuelito part. It might not have been John Manuelito, but Max was working with the government to show, in case it didn't work out to get in the lens below for his dad, that he was... Like, he was trying to gain favor with that side of the battle, because it would better their name.
I agree. I'm glad you rephrased it, because I agree with what you just said. Delbert, what do you give it?
I still can't do anything higher than a 6, because we went from going to basically try to befriend Manuelito to literally slamming him against the ground and walls.
Yeah, to be honest, I was thinking 4, maybe 5.
Okay.
Alex did get the last laugh, and you're right that Max is trying to gain favor with the government, but the mechanism by which he's doing that is not the same as what you said necessarily. So
I was thinking 5 before he defended his point. So, I mean, he gained a point for me.
Right. I was at 3 before the point defense.
Oh.
So I'm going to stick with a 4 here.
Okay. Brutal.
So a 4 from Brady and a 6 from Delbert. Sounds good.
Yeah, chalk it up as a 5.
Average of a 5. So not the best.
Once you've written those scores down, Baylor, why don't you go ahead and ask us your questions about your next prediction, which will cover chapters 30, called The Lands Below, and 31, called Bowie... Bui, and the Lagaru.
I don't know.
Bui and the Lagaru.
Inverarity, right in.
Oh boy. Okay.
I bet it says in the audiobook.
So,
I bet it does.
Yeah, check that out. There's a link in the description. So let's see. So Brady, I'm going to ask you this question.
Okay.
In the next 2 chapters, do Alex and Maximilian stumble upon an enemy? And what I mean by that is there basically a fight scene where they have to protect themselves?
Yes.
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 Okay. And then Delbert. What are the people called that, or what are the creatures called that live in the lands below that have this deal with the Confederation?
Well, you see, I would argue that that's a spoiler for a future episode.
So you want me to ask a different question?
Nah, they're called the generous ones.
Oh, okay. Okay. The generous ones, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, don't look ahead at the chapter titles or...
That's fair. All right.
Using that information, Baylor, make a prediction for us.
Okay. Let me formulate that prediction real quick.
I'd like a request in my prediction.
What's that?
You've been given the knowledge that there will be a fight. I want to know who or what they're fighting. In your prediction, preferably.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
Are you offering bonus points?
Oh, I'll give him 5 bonus points if he nails it, and if he's close, I'll give him 3.
Okay.
Okay. So for my prediction, I believe, obviously, they will end up in the lands below because they fell through the floor, and they will run into the fight scene. Who they'll be fighting, I think it'll be Confederation wizards that are down there, because I think because there's this deal with these creatures, the generous ones, that the Confederation having been tipped off that, oh, people are going into the lands below, you know, for the Mors Mortis Society, they will be down there ready to protect these people. So that's what I think will be in the fight. Regarding the BY and the Lagaru, honestly, I think that that is the people, or the leader, I guess, of the people, of the generous ones. And so, speaking with BY after defending themselves against these Confederation wizards, there will be discussions about Abraham Thorne, what must be done, what must be offered, and what will be received. What will be offered is protection in the overworld and reuniting with the Native Americans. And then what will be received is obviously Abraham Thorne's power over the Confederation because he has this massive weapon of theirs.
Excellent.
It's going to be a very interesting next couple chapters, that's sure. For sure. And I think with that being said, unless you guys have anything else, it's time to end.
It is.
Before we end, I do just want to say that I will not ever apologize for the anti-Thorn bias on this podcast.
As of right now.
Unless it's...
I will, so I'm sorry.
Unless it's proven that we're just totally wrong, I'm not going to apologize for it.
Nice. I want to bring up a reality that you guys have never thought of. And we don't have enough time to debate it, so you're just going to have to accept it.
Sounds good.
When Harry, Ron, and Hermione knock out some Death Eaters, Ron says, in the movie, Hermione, you're the best with memory charms. You should work on them. This is in relation to the fact that Sirius died in Book 3, and Hermione just warped Harry's memories for 2 years, hoping that he would eventually be able to get over it.
Makes more sense than most of the Cursed Child, so. With that being said, I've been Brady.
I've been Delbert.
I've been Baylor.
We'll see you next Sunday.
Maybe.
Good night.